Monday, October the 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us. Coming up, Doctors Without Borders Hospital attacked in Afghanistan.
It is a tragedy that the Doctors Without Borders, that they have lost some personnel in this particular attack.
Also ahead, deadly violence in Niger and Nigeria, plus Russia's air campaign in Syria. We'll have some analysis. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter pledged on Sunday a full and transparent investigation of an airstrike at a hospital in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz that left at least 22 people dead. That bombing triggered a firestorm of criticism from aid groups, including the international medical charity Doctors Without Borders, which operated the medical facility. Afghan authorities said Sunday that 10 to 15 Taliban fighters were hiding in the hospital and on its grounds. Afghan troops backed by U.S. airstrikes have been engaged in heavy fighting in Kunduz against the Taliban militants who took over the city last week. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Indiana University South Asia expert Najif Sarani for his reaction to the attack on the Kunduz hospital.
It's unfortunate. But the reports also say that quite a lot of Taliban who were there have been also killed in this particular attack.
Well, in Kabul, the Ministry of Defense said Taliban fighters had attacked the hospital and were using the building as a human shield. But Doctors Without Borders categorically denied that, saying it was disgusted by recent statements coming from the Afghan government authorities justifying the attack.
Well, if that is indeed the case, that the information is coming from the Doctors Without Borders disputing the government's claims, then I can't quite understand why the United States forces who were called in to help the Afghan forces on the ground would have targeted a hospital. So my suspicion is that there may have been Taliban, and the Taliban may have, in fact, I mean, obviously doctors by their oath cannot discriminate against people who were injured and brought to them, whether they are Taliban, non-Taliban. To them probably shouldn't matter, and that didn't matter. But I suppose to others who were probably looking at the situation from the ground, it may have been a target as far as they were concerned. And it is a tragedy that Doctors Without Borders is a very, very helpful institution, health and medical care institution, not just in Afghanistan, a lot of other places. And it really is a tragedy that they have lost some personnel in this particular attack.
Now, we know that similar attacks earlier under the administration of Hamid Karzai would have been roundly condemned. What impact might this have on President Ashraf Ghani's relations with Washington?
You know, it's hard to tell. Ashraf Ghani hasn't said much. I mean, it's the incompetence and ineptness of his administration that has led the situation to this tragedy. His governor, of course, one of apparently his close friends, had been outside the country for Eid or some such thing. So there was no coordination. There's even reports that the government, some elements within the government, the fifth column, may have been involved in, and many also consider this to have been an inside job, that somebody from inside government and within the Kunduz administration may have allowed the Taliban to have their people in the city with weapons, well located, and then, you know, some people may have been attacking from outside the city, coming into Kunduz, but in fact, much of the job was done from inside the city already with people who had been positioned in strategic places in the city to take the city for the 2-3 days that they did, and the tragedy that has ensued since.
Was the attack by the Taliban on Kunduz a week ago a moral victory for them?
Well, obviously, they're making a big deal out of it. I mean, in fact, this is the first in 14 years since the U.S. intervention. You remember, the very first days, Kunduz was a major site where a lot of fighting took place, and also this was the place where thousands, maybe some people say 10,000 or more, Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and others who were located there had been flown by Pakistani planes to Pakistan. So in since then, since the fall of Kunduz, in which I think General Dostum and some of his men were present, involved in routing the Taliban on the ground, nothing like this has happened. So the fact that it happens on the anniversary of Ashraf Ghani's taking power telling about where this administration is headed.
Will this likely push the moribund peace process even further back from reality?
I don't think there was ever a real peace process intended by Pakistan or by Taliban. But indeed, this may be another excuse to even justify not wanting to be involved in anything so-called peace negotiations, if such a thing indeed was ever on the table.
Aziz Shirani is a professor of Central Eurasian Studies at Indiana University. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. And now let's check in with International Edition's G. Abby Lee about what's trending online about the events in Kunduz. G, why don't we begin with the Twitter handle for Doctors Without Borders, which we know also is known by the French acronym MSF.
Hi, Steve. It's at MSF after its French acronym. And of course, that's the best handle to follow for the latest news coming out of Kunduz. Doctors Without Borders describes itself as an international, independent, medical humanitarian organization. Let's begin with its pinned tweet, which reads like this. On bombing of MSF hospital in Kunduz. We cannot accept that this horrific loss of life will simply be dismissed as, quote, collateral damage, unquote. About 2,400 people share the tweet from Saturday, and it's been marked as a favorite nearly 1,000 times.
I see. And the collateral damage wording is from the U.S. military statement that drew international outcry?
Exactly.
What about some recent tweets from MSF?
It revealed the latest death toll in a tweet, which is 22, as you mentioned earlier. Now, that includes 12 staff members and 10 patients. It also tweeted, not a single member of his staff reported any fighting inside a hospital compound prior to the U.S. airstrike Saturday morning.
Gee, I know the airstrike is getting a lot of criticism from around the world. Can you give us some examples?
Sure. Amnesty International, the ICRC, and various UN agencies are all tweeting about the incident. This is what Amnesty International tweeted. It's sickening to think that doctors and staff had to pay with their lives while trying to save others. Hashtag Kunduz, hashtag MSF, hashtag Afghanistan. The official Twitter account of the UN Human Rights Office at UN Rights Wire tweeted this. Hashtag Kunduz hospital airstrikes, utterly inexcusable. Full, transparent investigation needed now.
Pretty strong words. How popular is the hashtag Kunduz?
That hashtag was used in almost 27,000 tweets in the last 24 hours. Not as popular as, say, hashtag Eagles, the U.S. sports team, which was used in 76,000 tweets. The figures are from the Topsy Analytics website. Steve?
Many thanks, G. That's International Edition's G. Abby Lee. If you'd like to follow G on Twitter, her handle is at G. Abby Lee. And you can also follow International Edition on Twitter. We're at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
This is VOA's International Edition. Arab media reports say Russian warplanes have launched several dozen air raids over parts of Syria during the last 24 hours, intensifying their attack against opposition groups opposed to the Syrian government. Edward Uranian reporting now from the VOA Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Syrian government media reported heavy airstrikes on opposition-held towns of Homs and Idlib. The Russian Defense Ministry showed videos of bombs striking what they claimed were arms depots and terrorist command centers. Video from Syrian opposition groups showed victims of what they claimed were Russian airstrikes on the towns of Telbisi and Rastan. Syrian opposition leader Khaled al-Hoja claimed most of the Russian attacks were aimed at what he called moderate opposition targets. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And for some perspective on the Russian air campaign in Syria, we turn to VOA's Carol Castiel, who speaks with Ali Soufan, a former FBI agent and an expert on terrorism, who is now chairman and CEO of the Soufan Corporation. Carol asked him for his thoughts on whether Russia's airstrikes in Syria are anti-Islamic State or an effort to support Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
I think Russia is not looking at its campaign in Syria as an anti-ISIS campaign. They are looking at the campaign as a pro-regime campaign, pro-Assad campaign. And I think they send a very strong message from day one when they bombed locations that some of it has nothing to do with ISIS. So you had airstrikes against al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. You had also airstrikes against Ahrar al-Sham, which is an Islamist organization very closely associated with al-Nusra and with al-Qaeda Central. However, it's also independent from them, and Ahrar al-Sham is closely connected with Turkey. So it was a strong message that their campaign is a pro-Assad campaign, not anti-terrorism campaign. The Russians feel the militant groups in Syria, regardless if they were FSA or Islamists or Qaeda or ISIS, everyone who is fighting the regime is going to be, according to them, considered terrorists. Also, the groups that they targeted, I believe they were sending a message to the regional backers. As you know, in Syria, after 4 years of conflict, every group is supported by someone or a country. And I think bombing these groups was also a strong message from the Russians to the regional backers. It seems after 4 years, Russia found an opportunity to interfere in Syria. Again, the Russians were looking for their national interest in Syria. Remember, Syria throughout the Cold War was a country that operated under the Soviet influence. It continued to be a pro-Russia, and Russia have significant naval bases, especially in the Latakia and Tartus. So Russia has a lot to lose if the Assad regime ceases to exist.
When you say opportunity, are you saying that he saw what some say is a sense of weakness on the part of the United States or the Western alliance?
It's a combination. I mean, after you have thousands of refugees going to Europe, most of the Europeans now, they understand that the only way you can deal with the issue of foreign fighters, the only way you can deal with the influx of refugees is to basically stop the Syrian civil war. I mean, you can put all the policies in place, but all these strategies, all these programs, all the idea of limiting refugees, how many refugees you take, how can we stop foreign fighters, is nothing if the fire is still going on in the Syrian kitchen. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the things that he realized, that there is no agreement in the West. There is no agreement even between the United States and Europe on how to deal with the Syria issue. So that's number one. So when he comes and say, hey, I'm going to finish that, a lot of people in Europe will be like, maybe we should let him finish it. Let Syria be his problem. Another thing with the Assad opposition, it's still very fragmented. You have the moderates, extremely weak at this point, as we've seen. Most of the people we train, when they cross the border, they give some of their equipments, if not all their equipments, that we gave them to al-Nusra and to al-Qaeda. That indicates a sense of weakness among the moderate opposition. Also, in the same time, I think he realizes that he is at a stage where he can do a lot of bombings in Syria from the air. He, I think, believe, and the Russians know, that air campaign is not enough to accomplish any gains on the ground. Just look at our air campaign for the last year or so. But I think he probably believes that the Syrian army is still at a position to take advantage of the air campaign and air support that he's giving them. It's yet to be seen if they will be successful in doing so. You know, we had a lot of experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think when he was in the KGB, they had a lot of experiences in Afghanistan, and so far it didn't turn up well for either us or them. So there are a lot of things to keep in mind, and I think it's a very dangerous escalation in the conflict, and I think the only people who will be further damaged with these kind of escalations are the Syrian people. Unfortunately, they will continue to suffer.
Ali Soufan is a former agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and expert on terrorism, who is now chairman and CEO of the Soufan Group. He was speaking with Carol Castiel, host of the VOA program Press Conference USA. And you can hear more of their conversation at our website, voanews.com. All you have to do is look under the Programs tab for Press Conference USA. Also in the news, militants claiming loyalty to the Islamic State say they were behind two Friday explosions in two neighborhoods of the Nigerian capital, Abuja, that killed at least 15 people, wounded dozens of others, although Boko Haram has carried out similar attacks. In June of last year, more than 20 people were killed and dozens wounded in a bomb blast in a popular city shopping area. And a dozen suicide attacks on Sunday, a double suicide in southeastern Niger, has left at least 8 people dead, including 4 bombers, that in the city of Diffa, in what is believed to be another spillover attack involving jihadists, with Boko Haram operating primarily in Nigeria. Niger has joined Nigeria and Cameroon in forming joint military operations to defeat the Sunni Islamist group, blamed for thousands of deaths in their 6-year insurgency. Since February, Diffa has suffered multiple attacks. In June, militants killed at least 38 people in raids on 2 villages in the Diffa region. We're going to shift our attention now to Uganda, where the overuse of antibiotics has resulted in high rates of drug-resistant bacteria. Pharmacists and health specialists are now stepping up a campaign to combat that problem. Lisbeth Pola reporting from Kampala.
Although it is technically illegal to distribute antibiotics without a prescription in Uganda, pharmacies are often teeming with customers buying the drugs with little or no oversight. Over time, bacteria have built up resistant to the overused drugs. Studies find that in Uganda, 80% of the bacteria that cause diseases such as pneumonia or tuberculosis are resistant to antibiotics. Advocates say part of the problem is understaffing. Uganda has only 600 pharmacists for a population of 37 million. This leaves many to self-prescribe, especially in rural areas. Kennedy Odokunyero, the speaker of the Makerere University Pharmacy Students Association, says villagers can do this because they have hoarded the drugs.
So if they get to know that there's a new supply, National Medical Stores has just supplied that health facility. So on a Monday morning, everyone in the village will come. Their thing is they want to get the medicines because they sell a lot of it, get the medicines and take it to their homes and keep it, so that in the event that they fall sick, they have the medicines just there, so they use it.
The Rational Medical Use campaign, now being rolled out by the Pharmaceutical Society of Uganda, is using social media and community outreach to urge citizens to get an accurate diagnosis before starting medication. It also discourages the sharing of medicines and reminds people to finish their prescribed doses. Uganda National Academy of Sciences Global Antibiotic Resistance Partnership has also published a report attempting to tackle the problem of antibiotic abuse. Professor Dennis Biarugaba, a microbiologist who chairs the group, says clinicians and pharmacists are the first line of defense.
Because the common person, I mean, given our education levels, may not appreciate what all this means. But for somebody who has been in the medical school or has been through any kind of professional medical-related field, should understand really what it means every time they administer or they dispense an antibiotic without a prescription, without knowing that actually this person has got a bacterial infection.
Medical professionals are hoping that by making the public aware of the dangers, they can stop the abuse of antibiotics and allow new drugs to remain effective when they come on the market. Elizabeth Pola, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
And remember, you can stay on top of the news at our website, voanews.com. Still ahead on International Edition, the latest album from singer Selena Gomez. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The bubonic plague, or Black Death, killed nearly half the population of Europe back in the mid-14th century. Scientists have thought that the bacterium that causes the plague, Yersinia pestis, evolved over only the past 20,000 years. But now scientists at Oregon State University are confident that they have found an ancient strain of the deadly bacteria attached to a flea that became encased in amber about 20 million years ago. The scientists say that its size, shape, and other characteristics are consistent with modern forms of those bacteria. If this fossil bacteria are actually related to what caused the Black Death, it would provide evidence that the deadly disease has been around and has traveled much of the world longer than the human race has been in existence. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. She is one of the most popular entertainers today in terms of sales and social media presence. Following a public romance and breakup with singer Justin Bieber, Selena Gomez is out on her own with a new release from her latest album. VOA's Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald tells us more in the studio with International Edition's host Jim Stevenson.
Selena Gomez is somebody I even know. A singer, actress, fashion designer, and she's got a new song out.
That's right. And Selena Gomez has her second solo album, Revival, coming out October 9th. In many ways, you could say this is a debut set. I think she sort of regards it that way. This is going to be her first album on the Interscope label. All of Selena's other albums, both solo and with her old band, The Scene, were done on Hollywood Records, which is a Disney-owned company. And of course, Selena has been part of the Disney stable, or had been part of the Disney stable, since she was a young teenager. She did TV shows and movies, and so she was very much, you know, the clean-cut Disney girl. And then for the last couple of years, I guess she's occupied a place in the public imagination as Justin Bieber's on-and-off girlfriend. So she was in the tabloids. And she says she's sick of the noise. She's sick of other people defining who she is and what she's all about. And she's really looking to break out with Revival.
Well, a good way to do that, if you just want to get away from everything, is get in the studio by yourself in front of a microphone and belt out a good song.
That's exactly it. Here it is, the second single from Selena's upcoming album, Revival, out October 9th. This is called Same Old Love.
I'm so sick of that.
She's worked with some great people on this album. Her new single, Same Old Love, features co-writing from Charlie XCX, a British pop star who's gaining a reputation as a real song crafter for other acts, as well as a star in her own right. And even Max Martin had a hand in this album. And Max is a Swedish songwriter-producer who is, at this point, the most popular and successful pop songwriter on Earth, even though most people don't know who he is.
Right. I was just going to say, probably one of the most incredible talents you never knew about.
That's exactly right.
And I was reading that Selena Gomez was also looking up to Taylor Swift as a role model. There's another tie-in there. Taylor Swift, of course, very successful on her own and answers to no one but herself and her fans.
Well, yeah, Selena is part of Taylor Swift's girl posse, and those two may work together at some point in the future.
The possibilities are endless. Ray McDonald, as always, a pleasure to have you in the studio. Follow Ray on Twitter at Ray on the Hits.
Thank you, Jim.
You know, I have to agree with Ray. Selena Gomez, well, she's come a long way since those days at Disney. Amazing, amazing. Nice song, though, huh? Listen, everyone, thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned for that. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A resurgence of sectarian violence in the Central African Republic, or CAR, raises grave concerns for that country's political transition and respect for the human rights of all its citizens. Many fear that the violence, in which 41 people have died since September 25th, could degenerate into civil war if not contained soon. The international community has been unanimous in its condemnation of the attacks on and among civilians and against humanitarian workers. We have also called for the perpetrators to be brought to justice and appealed for militias to lay down arms now. Meanwhile, more than 1.5 million Central Africans have expressed their wish for a break with the old ways of violence by registering to vote in elections originally scheduled for later this month. It is critical that the elections take place to allow a democratically elected government to lead the citizens of the Central African Republic to lasting peace and recovery. The United States reaffirms its support for the ongoing political transition process and congratulates transitional authorities for recently completing a draft constitution. Gerard Hodel, with the U.S. delegation to the UNHRC, stated, "The Central African Republic has a unique opportunity in the coming months to move decisively toward peace, reconciliation, and justice. Clearly, stopping the violence and seizing that opportunity will be critical for the country's future. The U.S., while encouraged by recent handovers of several hundred child soldiers to UNICEF, remains deeply concerned about the several thousand children who remain in armed groups. The U.S. strongly recommends that the transitional government, with international community support, prioritize their return. The U.S. also condemns attacks by armed groups against humanitarian convoys and peacekeepers and fully supports the effort of the U.N. mission in the Central African Republic and French forces under Operation Sangaré to work with the Central African Republic authorities to reestablish law and order. And we welcome the UN Secretary General's pledge to enforce a zero-tolerance policy for UN forces who sexually abuse Central Africans, including children. The U.S. is committed to working with transitional authorities and its international partners to help the CAR's transition to a democracy where the rights of all citizens are respected."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.